how will you vote if it comes to a vote on this resolution to end the Watergate hearings that Senator Dole is planning to introduce?
I will not. I will vote against it. I believe that Watergate has to be examined to the end, no matter whom it affects. I think this is a fundamental moral issue of our government. And by the way, it raises in question all campaign practices and campaign contributions. And I forgot to list among what I considered urgent measures, reform of campaign financing and the way in which campaigns are run. As far as I'm concerned, as a senator from our state, I do not believe that I can remotely support the idea that anything goes in politics. You've got to be decent and moral to deserve to be a servant of the people, and we've got to enforce it by law. And that's what Watergate's all about. So I'm all for carrying it through to the end, including prosecutions in the courts and the inquiry by the Congress, and I will vote against aborting it in any way.
I ask this question in light of your role with NATO. Is this a good time for the president to go to Europe? Is things set up well enough there that he could be useful going, say, in the latter part of October, has been suggested, or maybe should have waited until next year?
Roland, it is not the best time, but it's an essential time, and I'll tell you why. The strains are becoming very great as between the United States and Europe in respect of money and trade. There's grave danger of protectionism in the European common market, which could enormously complicate the future of the United States. An agreement must be made respecting the world's money, which puts the world right now, because it hasn't been made, in the gravest jeopardy. And then we've got to rationalize our participation in the defense of Europe, with all the cost and expense and the stationing of American troops there. So while I thoroughly agree that it is not the optimum time, next year would be better from the point of view of getting over Watergate and many other things. But the issues won't wait, and the president's job is to administer the country. And so, in my judgment, he should go now.
Senator, on the NATO issue, what is your position on our troop strength over there? Do you have any specifics on it?
I believe that if the president goes, he can negotiate a reduction in troop strength, especially in connection with the negotiations which we're going to undertake with the Russians beginning this fall on what's called mutual balanced troop reductions. I believe that a modest drawdown of U.S. troops there, something in the area of 10 to 20,000, nobody's going to lose any sleep over if a military consolidation makes that make sense. I think what will be a very upsetting thing to Europe, with repercussions not only in the security field, but in the economic and political fields as well, would be the major drawdown that Senator Mansfield's resolution talks about. And I don't think we ought to do that except in a reciprocal agreed negotiations with the European countries. And it's one of the big reasons why I think the president has to go, because I think that's what we ought to do, and that's the end to which we ought to come as promptly as possible. Well, thank you very much, Roland Powell and John Obazinski, for being with us on this report to the people. And I hope that all those of New York who are listening now will listen to this, as they have to this, to our next broadcast as well. Thank you, gentlemen. This is Senator Javits with another report to the people of the state of New York. Before I go into the question and answer part of our program, I'd like to say a few words about some very important current developments. One is passage of a bill to secure pension and welfare funds in the United States. About 30 million workers are involved with about $150 billion in assets. And what this bill is doing is to strengthen the opportunity of the individual worker to have his right to a pension vested in him if he works for as long as 15 years, in some cases even shorter, with full vesting at the end of 10 years, and his right to some part of the pension beginning when he's worked as little as 5 years, 25%, going up 5% a year for the first 5 years, and then 10% a year. Also, that he be insured in getting the pension, in the fact that we're going to have government insurance for pensions, just like we have for bank deposits and for stock brokerage accounts. There are many other aspects to the bill, including an improvement for retirement savings to those who are self-employed, doctors, lawyers, engineers, and similar professionals. And even the worker who is not now covered by his employer's pension plan will also get a new opportunity to have a pension plan of his own, being able to lay aside a fair amount of tax-free dollars every year for the purpose of saving up for his future retirement. And in that same connection, this is a monumental bill, a great reform in American life, and should at long last give our older citizens a real feeling that they can, together with Social Security, have a decent income in their older years. It's a bill that I pioneered about 6 years ago, and now it's coming into fruition, and one of the most gratifying things that has happened to me and could happen to the people of our state and nation during my whole Senate service. Another matter that this raises is the Chrysler settlement, a landmark settlement which has been made for the following reasons. One, it gives workers an opportunity to participate in the process of production. They have the opportunity to decide something about how production processes are to be handled, about whether they will or won't work overtime, about what ought to be safety and health standards in the plant. It's a settlement which goes far beyond the normal settlement of what's going to be in the wage package, because it also deals with pensions. A worker is entitled to retire at the end of 30 years of work, no matter what his age, which is a remarkable advance. Altogether, this settlement, even though the wage aspects of it again show the great restraint labor has been showing in respect of wage settlements. It's not all that big in terms of the immediate pay package. But in the total worker cooperation in the economy as between labor and management, and in the new opportunities for the worker for a decent life on retirement, this is really a landmark, a very exciting situation. One further point, there are a lot of predictions about energy shortages this winter, and they are very possible in terms of possible maldistribution or actual insufficiency in oil imports, though I hope very much that this will not be the case. Nonetheless, maldistribution may be a factor, and so I shall strongly favor the power in the federal government to bring about allocations of scarce energy supplies like home heating fuel and gasoline should these maldistributions develop, and there's considerable fear that it will come particularly in New England or in our area of the country, certainly in the northern areas of the state of New York. Now, the administration is beginning to understand that a great deal of our home heating needs are supplied by the independents, and that we simply will not let the major oil companies starve the independents out of supplies and thus make great difficulties for the homeowner. There are lots of other things, including our new Secretary of State, Dr. Kissinger, that I talked to you about, but I think that that I've covered some of the main new things which have been going on. And now I'd like to introduce to you Alan Emery, very distinguished correspondent of the Watertown Times from our own state, who is with me here in the studio and will be asking me some questions. Alan?
Thank you very much, Senator. To take your opening point first, you've managed to get the pension bill into the Senate pipeline very nicely. But what about the House of Representatives? Do you think you can get passage of the bill through the House without strong support from the White House?
I think we can, but I think we will have support from the White House. This is not a budgetary bill. Essentially, it's the self-help bill. It relates to private pension plans. The White House, too, has had a plan. We're not following it completely, but we've taken a lot of it into consideration in respect of the Senate bill. Also, there's strong sentiment in the House of Representatives by Wilbur Mills, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And by the way, we have a fine New Yorker, Barbara Conable, on that committee, one of our congressmen. And by Congressman Dent of Pennsylvania from the Labor Committee in the House. So I think, and the public demand is so great for reform of the private pension system, so people really get a break, because as it goes now, most people are disappointed with their private pension plans, and they get very little out of them. and relatively few get anything out of them. So I believe that with the public support, White House interest, and the strong feeling I feel is running in the House, I look for this to become law within the first few months of 1974.
Senator, you mentioned public disappointment. There seems to be some public disappointment with the end result of 4.5 phases of economic game plans now. Do you think the administration ought to phase out its economic game plans and start all over again?
Well, I think they ought to stop playing games with the plans and turning them on and off. I think that phase two was working well and had fairly strict wage and price controls, was even working well in the food sector, when it was suddenly dismantled on some theory that we were ready to go off controls in phase three. That proved to be a disaster. Now we've got phase four, which is kind of inching back toward where we were. I hope the administration will no longer make people feel that, well, plans are just momentary for wage and price control, we're going off it, but that we're determined to keep them on so long as we need them and to administer them strongly, to do their utmost to affect the food sector where prices have run away impossibly, and not to make promises that we're going off them tomorrow. I believe that if we do that, we have a good chance to go off them in about a year. But I think it's counterproductive to give people an idea that, well, they're not really important anyhow, and the sooner you release the economy, the sooner prices will be stable. I think if you release the economy prematurely, we'll have the same debacle again, only even worse because it's mounted on the shoulders of what we already have that we had when we came out of phase two.
Well, now, in relation to the food price question, you've introduced a bill to control the question of exports so that we won't have another scandal like the Russian wheat deal, and to make sure that domestic needs are taken care of before we allocate farm goods for export. What chance, have you had any reaction from the administration on that yet?
I haven't had it from the administration, but I've had it from other senators. I've had an excellent reaction. It is a plan. I won't bemuse our people with the details in this way. We don't have that much time. But it is a plan by which after domestic needs are satisfied, plus domestic reserves, plus reserves for catastrophe, like Bangladesh or the starvation, which I just saw myself only a week or so ago, in Africa, in the so-called Sahel region on the West African coast, that we determine in advance what we have available for export and confine our exports to that fairly divided among the countries of the world, the industrial countries and the developing countries. That will have a tendency to keep prices down because the competition of very high prices at exports tends to bring up domestic prices. But I think our people should know that agricultural exports are essential. We buy a lot in the world, too, including oil. And in order to get the foreign exchange for that purpose, one of our main exports is becoming food, because we are the leading surplus nation in food. And though we have our own troubles in terms of price, we could have even bigger troubles if our industrial machine were compelled to grind to a halt because we didn't have the overseas income from our own exports to buy the things we need. And so my bill endeavors to respect American needs and American prices, but at the same time, by wise planning in advance, to give us the opportunity to sell, because we've got to sell agricultural surplus in terms of the needs of the world, which is short of grain throughout the world, and in terms of our own necessities.
Well, Senator, you've almost anticipated my next question. Because we've talked about the confusion over the economic game plans. We've talked about the Russian wheat deal, which created confusion on supplies on food. There's no welfare program now likely to go before Congress. Does the administration really do enough long-range planning on major issues to satisfy you?
I think the administration does not, but neither does any other administration. And it's one of the big problems with our country. We need a piece of machinery in this country which will deal with national goals. Now, we don't have to have a Goss plan or a Russian type or communist type plan for 3 or 5 years.
But something more than tomorrow.
We have to have something on the drawing board and a blueprint. And I might tell you that the author of that idea was none other than General Eisenhower. And he had in his administration a national planning effort over a 5 to 10 year swing of time. I tried to recreate that by law. I'm still trying. It's absolutely essential to our country. By the way, the French have it, which it doesn't involve compulsion, but it involves at least asking various sectors of the national economy to fit into what looks like the forecast for the economy as a whole. We do it year by year through the Council of Economic Advisers. Hence, we're always running after an economic bus that's already passed us by, because a year is a very short time in the life of such a great nation. And so I'm very hopeful to be very effective in that regard, and to bring as a permanent thing into the American establishment some concept of planning ahead for 5 or 10 years. Most businesses plan ahead for 10 years. American Tell, the steel companies, the General Motors, all the big companies do that, but the federal government does not, and it's high time we did.
One of the hot areas of speculation in Washington this week, Senator, has been the matter of Vice President Agnew and his future. What effect do you think a resignation by the Vice President would have?
Well, Alan, I would not like to speculate on such a resignation, because I think that the Vice President, and I think people have a pretty good idea of how I stand on him in terms of politics, but as an American and a man holding such very high office, I think his civil liberties have in effect been violated. All this information emanating on the fact that he's being investigated for various very immoral charges respecting bribery, etc., which has been so noised about and supported even by a declaration by the Department of Justice that he was being investigated, is pretty rough on a person who's entitled to be considered innocent until proven guilty in a fair trial like every other American. Now, so I don't want to speculate on that. I think it's most unfair to the Vice President. He's already been treated quite unfairly. But from the point of view of the country, I believe that just like the Watergate scandal involving the presidency and those close to the presidency, it'll show the power of our institutions. We're not going to be thrown should that dread eventuality occur. And I don't welcome it, and I think any American does, for a man in such high office. But I think if it should occur, it'll show the strength of these institutions. Our law fully covers the designation of a new vice president. Immediately. And that we would not have any constitutional crisis.
Do you think that the speculation has in any way weakened the administration?
Well, naturally it does, but go on and again showing the strength and validity of American institutions. Well, Alan, our time's up. Thank you, Alan Emery of the Watertown Times, and thank you, everyone, for listening. This is Senator Jacob Javits with another report to the people of the state of New York. In the last few days, I've been up visiting in the Rochester, Canandaigua area of our state. And I found a tremendous interest, naturally, it gets pretty cold up there pretty soon, in the problems of the so-called energy crisis. I believe our whole state is greeted with considerable approval. The beginning of an allocation system to be sure that supplies of scarce gas, scarce heating oil, and perhaps tomorrow scarce gasoline will be fairly allocated among all our people, and that the egalitarian nature of our society will be preserved in that way. This is especially the case in many parts of our own state of New York, where heating oil is sold by independent dealers. Who have had quite a job keeping their head above water with the larger companies that are their raw material suppliers, rather preferring their own sources and outlets rather than the independent dealers who in turn deal with tens of thousands of homeowners. So the allocation system the president has announced has been very welcome. As to propane gas, he now promises to extend it to heating oil, and if that kind of a crunch should come, I would expect, and I certainly fight for, extending it to gasoline alone. Now, when I was up in New York, I met with several hundred gasoline dealers who claimed they're being very much discriminated against by the Cost of Living Council in respect of price and wage control, and I have a most distinguished guest here who heads that agency and who will very shortly explain to you exactly what is the attitude of that council so important on this subject. He is Dr. John Dunlop, the chairman of the Cost of Living Council. Dr. Dunlop, I'd like to ask you, what is the rationale for the effort of the Cost of Living Council to satisfy by a new regulation the gasoline dealers? I'll tell you what their complaint is to me, and if you'd be kind enough to answer it, because I propose to fight for them, as I should. They complain that, one, you've now allowed them to pass through the increased cost of gasoline to them, but only the increased cost which accumulated up to September 28th last. They claim, and the press reports bear them out, that there's already been another increase to many of them, and hence that they're not permitted as yet, you may allow that later, to pass that through. In the meantime, they're caught in a squeeze, unlike other retailers who do have a wholesale price passed through, and that there's no reason why you should put this restriction on them. I don't mean you personally, I mean your council.
Yes.
Second claim, that's one. Second claim, that you allow them in the fixed price a certain amount of overhead, that you have established at their overhead on May 15th last, that their overhead has materially increased since then, and again, that they ought to have the opportunity frequently, much more frequently, to adjust their overhead, otherwise they're caught in yet another squeeze. And I tell you, Doctor, they feel so strongly that the several hundred came out with their tow trucks to impress me, and they did impress me, as many have who've come here, with what they consider to be the injustice of these decisions.
Well, Senator Jones, I'm delighted to talk about gasoline and heating oil and petroleum.
Okay.
You are aware that this is one of the two areas of our economy where prices have gone up most to the American consumer. The other, of course, is food. Heating oil prices have gone up at retail 22% since the first of the year, and gasoline 12 to 15%. And every evidence is that as world prices rise, we will have to raise domestic prices. So this is a matter of vital concern to all American consumers. And that is why we were enjoined by the president to develop price controls of a serious nature in this area. Now, the petroleum industry is large and complicated. And in order to control it, we had to start at crude oil. We have ceilings on crude oil prices in the United States. The large refiners may not put into increase price increases other than certain imports and crude oil increases, which I'll come to in a moment, without pre-notifying us. They have to bring their case to us. We get 30 days to look at it, so they cannot increase their prices. We have ceilings at these levels below the retailer. And we feel that it's essential to protect the consumer to have retail ceiling prices as well. Now, the one thing we want to do above everything else, however, is to be certain that the higher prices of world petroleum and gasoline can be passed through into the United States because we need the heating oil. We want the American consumer to be cold this winter. We want them to be able to have the gasoline, and that must come from abroad, as you know, having been so interested in energy in recent years. Now, our view is that we originally set a January date for the margins of these retailers. They complained to us about it. So we changed the system to provide a May 15th price. That actually contains a cent to a cent and a half greater margin for them than the January margin, which were already above what the 1972 margins were. And in our view, they were quite equitable. The data that we have received from them supports that view that these May margins are a cent to a cent and a half. Now, The final point I would make is that we do expect that we will get a little bit more price increase through the months of November and December as we import more oil, but that this large bulge we had in the months of September and October derives from all the increases back to May. And so we provided a cushion, we felt, so that the retailers would not be squeezed very hard by virtue of this process. We said that we would continually reassess the situation, and as you have implied, later on we would tend to raise those margins a little bit further. Gasoline has been so large in its price increases that there are a few areas in the country where we have put retail ceilings on. We did it in meat, as you remember very well, because of the beef shortage situation. We do it where we think the price controls will make a marginal contribution.
Well, Dr. Dunlop, isn't it a fact that these retailers, these gasoline retailers, who are all small business people with a few thousand dollars invested in a station, you're not dealing with powerful corporations, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, isn't it a fact that they're being treated differently from other retailers who have absolute wholesale pass-through and so on?
No, I don't think so in terms of the gasoline business. Take in gasoline, for example. The stations, the 10% of the gasoline stations that are owned by the majors, they cannot increase their prices, and they have not increased their prices except when we specifically authorize them to increase.
But are other retailers, you know, take any retailers in any kind of business, are they being tied down in respect of the wholesale price pass-through? Your retailers, for example, in supermarkets, etc., they have an absolute wholesale price pass-through.
But we, in those cases, kept to their margins of last year and their margins of January of this year. And that's what we started to do in this particular situation, started to those base margins.
Well, Dr. Dunlop, even a consumer representative who testified before us in the Joint Economic Committee, when he heard this testimony, this just a couple of weeks ago, matter of fact, you did too,
yes,
said that, sure, he realizes that you could kind of thumb down on these retail gasoline dealers, and that theoretically that would benefit the consumer. But no consumer, he felt, and I think he was right, wanted to take it out of the hide of the individual small businessman who had a gas station and was caught between these upper and neither millstones. So,
well, neither,
you know,
do we. Neither,
well,
do we.
This is the kind of a situation that we run into often in life. You're maintaining your position. You'll do what you think you have to do. But a person like myself, I think, has to fight for a reasonable justice to these small businessmen in terms of an absolute pass-through and a much more prompt adjustment to their increased overhead costs, because really, Doctor, you have to do what you have to do, and we're going to have to do what we have to do, including perhaps even congressional action. But it is a fact that I'm deeply impressed, and I think most of my colleagues are deeply impressed, with the fact that these small fellas are being squeezed between the upper millstone of their increase in overhead and the nether millstone of the inability to absolutely pass through wholesale price increases.
Well, I'd only make this final observation,
please,
Senator, on that our data, which comes from these people, shows that their margins are appreciably above what they were in January. We originally put in a minimum. We've now allowed an extra cent to a cent and a half, and all the evidence we have is that that is a liberal margin.
Well, Doctor, I'm not going to protract this argument. We'll carry it on elsewhere, but I did want to ask you a few other things. Labor has been very disciplined in this, generally speaking, in respect of its seeking wage increases to make up for price increases, especially in this runaway food price. Now, do you consider the 5.5% guideline to be viable, and do you feel that labor should continue this restraint? I do. I might tell you that. Because there is real hope of a stabilization of prices, and that their statesmanship, as a result, will pay off in handsome dividends to so many millions of our people who are in that category.
Well, Senator, as you know, wages and labor relations are a special interest to me. I, too, am of the view that the record of the last year shows that the standards established by the pay board are still viable. I would point out to you that there's a good bit more flexibility in them than perhaps a simple statement might envisage. For example, a number of contracts provide for a cost-of-living escalator, and that is done in about a quarter of the industrial workers in the country, and those wages are adjustments. We approve those sorts of adjustments under certain rules that are adopted. In my view, the year has been a moderate one on the wage side, and I, too, hope that we can get the food price thing in hand, because it wouldn't do us too much good in 1974 to simply have wage increases that seek to recoup temporary price increases from food.
Now, on that food problem, I've introduced a bill with Senator Adlai Stevenson to get abreast of the problem of exports of agricultural raw materials with the view toward not shutting it off from the United States, but regularizing it, including an allowance for the developing countries, catastrophes like the famine in West Africa right now, and the reasonable food which our people need here, and trying to do that in an orderly and advance planning way. Have you had a chance to look at that, or do you have any opinion on it?
I've only heard about it briefly, Senator. I'd like to comment on the basis of what you've said, just a couple of points. One is, I commend very much the notion of having some kind of regularized reporting or even licensing arrangement so that we know what's going on. When I first came in the early part of the year, it took a number of months until the president ordered that we know what is happening on the export front. I think that's absolutely indispensable. I also feel that exports cannot be simply handled in terms in these areas simply on the basis of the existing legislation. We do need additional powers, as you know, the president has asked for as well. Now, the question of allocations becomes a very complicated problem with respect to our international trade stance as we seek to get more liberal trade, and that's a more difficult problem.
Well, Dr. Dunlop, I didn't want to cut you short because it's fascinating and critically important, but you do agree with me then that that kind of a bill, assuming that I've described it accurately, could have a material effect upon the stabilization of domestic prices because of its control of export demand.
We do need added powers in this area.
The other thing, just to top this show off, and you've been so gracious, is that I hope next week, whenever I go on again, we'll be able to really dig into the future of the energy crisis. Thank you very much, Dr. John Dunlop of the Cost of Living Council, for being with me and the people of my state on this show.
Thank you, sir.